We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Harry Williamson is the producer for the program. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. This year, this program, Focus, turns 30. And we thought one thing that we could do to mark that anniversary would be to bring back some programs that we have not broadcast in a long time, and I've started to call them the deep archives. These are programs that go back to the time when we recorded the show every day on cassette, and they have been packed away in cardboard boxes and sitting on the shelf for a long time, and so haven't been heard in many years. And what we're doing is playing parts of these interviews, featuring some well-known guests, speaking on topics that we think are as important today and in some cases as controversial as they were when we first broadcast them, some of them as much as 20 years ago. Now, March is Women's History Month, so we've selected two interviews for this morning that both involve women's history, and they go back about as far as it's possible to go. Rheon Eisler is probably best known for her book, The Chalice and the Blade. This is a book that was first published in 1987 and continues to be available. She has long argued that prehistoric humans lived in a society where there was equality between female and male. And this is something that she calls the partnership model. She contrasts that with the dominator model, something that she says that came later with societies that were generally dominated by men. When we talked back in April of 1990, she began by explaining the two symbols that are in the title of her book, The Chalice and the Blade.
Well, the chalice and the blade really are on one, I mean, the book functions on many levels, but on one level, it's a very simple explanation. They're two symbols of power. The blade is the kind of power that we've been taught is the supreme power. It's the power over. And not coincidentally, we are presented very, very young with supreme deities that wield either a thunderbolt like Jehovah or a sword like Zeus. Actually, Zeus has both, so if we missed it the first time, you know, we get it the second time. This is certainly a type of power that's very appropriate for societies that orient primarily to what I've called a dominator model of society. But since remote antiquity, there's also been another symbol of power, and that, of course, is the chalice. And the chalice has since, now we're finding out through a veritable revolution in archaeology just how very far back that symbol of power goes. It's the symbol of a different kind of power. It's power to, power with. It's the symbol of life-giving, life-nurturing. And also, this is very important, and it ties in with this tremendous search that people are today experiencing for what they call a new spirituality. It's the power to illuminate life. And it really ties in with one aspect of the chalice and the blade, which is a veritable, really it reports findings from what British archaeologist James Maillard calls a veritable revolution in archaeology, which basically indicates that the first conceptualization of deity occurred in societies that were structured very differently from what we've been told, you know, a human society always has been and then by implication always must be, and that it was really that the ancients, well, they saw the obvious, life emerges from the body of woman, and they saw the world as a great mother from whose womb all of life ensues, to whose womb all of life returns at death, like the cycles of vegetation once again to be reborn. And it's very interesting if you think about something For example, one of the new scientific hypotheses is the so-called Gaia hypothesis that sees the world as a, not as a mechanical, you know, that Newtonian model, mm-hmm. but as a living, entity that supports and sustains and gives life. And, of course, it's really in some ways a scientific update of the belief system of these very, very ancient societies that we're now beginning to rediscover.
Well, I'd like to have you talk a little bit more about the evidence for the assertion that it was our first inclination, the way that society was first organized, that it be according to the more the principles of the chalice than of the blade. Some people have looked back at the archaeological record and they have reconstructed a past society which was dominated by men and their main activities, which mostly were hunting and killing animals. And you can see this sort of thing in cave paintings of hunting scenes, in burials where men were laid out mostly with their weapons. And with animal bones, perhaps they were animals they killed. They have some other sort of mystical significance, and so people have put all this together and have said, "Well, this really demonstrates that hunting and killing is somehow very fundamental activities to our nature. That they go back a long way, and then in fact that it's not surprising that society should be organized in a way that perhaps when you look at other groups of hunting carnivores in nature." It's perhaps not surprising that human society should be organized that way. Now, I know that there perhaps is newer evidence and that you read some of the evidence there is rather differently. What are some of the pieces that you have put together to form this rather different picture?
Well, you know, the pieces, let me start by saying something to you, that you're quite right, that the model for the evolution for what they call the story of man, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Which is very telling, because one of the things that distinguishes my work is that I draw from a database that not only includes the whole of our history, including new information about our prehistory, but also from a database that includes the whole of humanity, both its female and its male half. And that has made it possible to see patterns which were otherwise not visible, irregardless of new evidence. But you're quite right that the model was man, the hunter, and warrior. Now, and certainly it is true that although in the mainstream, and I want to stress this, in the mainstream of our cultural evolution, the orientation was primarily to the partnership model. And models are abstractions, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that there's a lot of data, that this new interpretation that I am giving is supported by the views of a lot of archaeologists, as well as people like Leakey, for example, who did some of the very, very early, I in my work only go back to the Paleolithic about 30,000 years ago in Western culture, and my work does deal with Western culture, although there is data supporting a similar interpretation in all the world centers of civilization. And of course, Leakey's work goes back millions of years, and he has for a very, very long time maintained that picture, for example, in 2001, you know, at the opening of that film, saying that the first tool was a club by a hominid, to kill, that's absolute nonsense. Because as we know that the first tools, as a matter of fact, were rounded sort of mortar-like stones used to soften vegetable fiber. And we also know that the major part of the diet from the very beginning of hominid development was not meat, as it certainly is not also in other primates, but that it is vegetable, so that the whole title of hunter-gatherer as the very beginning is a misnomer, okay? It should be gatherer-hunter. Now, there are certainly some burials that also show, the clashes of weapons and the strongman burials, but what we're beginning to find out now is that these are people who came pastoralists, who came from the fringes of the globe. I'm being a little nonlinear here, but let me tell you the picture that's now emerging.
Okay.
The picture that's emerging is that First of all, you start with a gathering hunting society, that was the Paleolithic, and that a lot of what was found in, I mean, I'm talking about Western civilization. Now, a lot of what was found in the European Paleolithic, which was interpreted at scenes of men hunting, yeah, sure, there are one or two scenes of men hunting, but a lot of the animal scenes, they're not hunting scenes at all. For example, Alexander Marshak, who was an outsider from the archaeological establishment, came in and solved the mystery of the so-called wrong way weapons, which was fascinating because there were these depictions in Paleolithic art of line drawings that in line with the model for the interpretation, you know, the paradigm of this is the story of man, the hunter and warrior, were interpreted as barbed weapons. But there were two problems. One was that the barbs seemed to be going the wrong way. Moreover, the so-called weapons were constantly missing their mark, and I quote from the books, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because they were sort of floating in air next to, or on the ground next to, the animal pictures. Well, Marshak comes in from the outside, and he looks at them through, you know, a long period of time, and he says, look, there's another interpretation. These were gathering hunting people, and these are clearly line drawings of vegetation. And, of course, you probably have guessed it now, that he also was able to say, and look, these so-called wrong-way barbs, they're branches, and they're going the right way. So the same thing with the so-called Venus figurines of the Paleolithic. The most frequently found sculpture were female. But in line with this whole idea that society always has been and always will be dominated by men, they were interpreted by some of the archaeologists as male erotica. But again, there was a problem. They were very large-hipped. A lot of them were pregnant. And the archaeologists were faced with this issue of why did these people have such strange Playboy pinups, if you will? Well, of course they weren't that at all, as James Maillart, as André Leroy-Gourhan, as some of the new scholars, Maria Gimbutas at UCLA, et cetera, are pointing out, and as people like E.O. James, who was a historian of religion, pointed out way back, these were early representations of a female deity of some kind. And then, of course, they make a lot of sense. They, if you see the world as a great mother, as I said, from whose womb all of life ensues, etc., that a lot of them would have been pregnant.
When we have talked about the partnership model, the earlier path that culture seemed to be on, we talked about its reverence for creating life, for the sources of life. And some people have argued that in fact earlier societies were organized along a matriarchal path instead of patriarchal. How do we know that in fact these early societies were in fact partnership societies and not societies that instead of being dominated by men, were in fact dominated by women?
I'm so glad you made it possible for me to get back to that, as I said I wanted to, David. Look, already in the 19th century, when archaeology was still in its infancy, and some of this evidence that there were societies that worshipped the great goddess, et cetera, societies that were structured differently, okay, where it looked like men don't dominate women. All right. What happened at that time was that the scholars of the day, if you're completely in the dominator mode, the obvious thing is then, well, if it wasn't a patriarchy, right, it had to be a matriarchy.
Mm-hmm.
But very soon, even in the early days, evidence began to also bubble up, indicating that men were not in these societies, in this oppressed, subordinate position that women have been more or less for the last, 3,000 to 5,000 years, because, you know, the shift was different and took longer in other parts of the world, like the Minoan island of Crete. Maybe we can talk about that for a moment later. They decided then that they must have been societies, as I said, where men dominated women. But the What became obvious is that men were not in this kind of a position. So a lot of the scholars heaved a big sigh of relief, and they said, well, you see, it was patriarchy after all. Now, what is some of the evidence that I'm talking about? For one thing, very early already, you see that, yes, there is the great goddess, but there are also, she had both divine daughters and divine sons. We see that even in the later iconography. For example, as I said, in Egypt, Isis, she has a divine son, Horus. In Greece, Demeter, she has a divine daughter, Persephone. In other words, there's a lot of evidence indicating that these were societies where both women and men were honored and even revered in the form of deity. Also, Çatalhöyük. There is, in the burials, there's evidence that, yes, there were priestesses, and priestesses played a very, very important part in these early cultures, but there were also priests. Also, in the burials, there isn't any evidence of the sort of, nothing like the chieftain burials, you know, of the strongman burials that come in later with sacrificed women and children and animals and the caches of weapons. Nothing like that in these cultures, but also in the what they call the burial gifts, the funerary gifts. There isn't a tremendous discrepancy between the female and the male either way, okay? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of data. Also, we have to sort of think of these societies in a kind of a different way, like the Minoan civilization, which was excavated in the island of Crete, which has some of the richest art ever found in the annals of civilization. Very different art from what we're used to, very spontaneous, the kind of art that only really reappears in the 19th and 20th century. Very, very fascinating if you look at some of the art as the partnership thrust got stronger in the 19th and 20th century, which it did. The art began to manifest some of the spontaneity and the joy of life in it. But one of the things that you also see in the Minoan civilization is that the way that they saw power, for example, they worshipped the great goddess, and there was probably a high priestess that represented her. But there's a picture of worship there that really tells the story in a very different way. There's a woman with her hands in a gesture of benediction, her arms up, but she's not bigger than anybody else, as in other dominator cultures. There isn't anybody kneeling or prostrating themselves at her feet. Quite the contrary, there are lines of people bringing her not burnt offerings of sacrificed animals, but fruits and grains. Very different way of looking at power. And I think what's so exciting is that so much of what's happening in our time, all the talk about a different view of power, a, quote, more feminine view, and I say, quote, because I think that it's very clear, whatever one takes away from this, this is not an issue of men against women or women against men. It's an issue of social organization, and that in a society where men are systematically taught to equate their identity, their masculinity, with domination, with conquest, where a little boy is handed a toy gun or a toy weapon and told, go get him, and only little girls are taught to be nurturing, you're going to get, you know, a very different kind of social organization than in societies where nurturing and caring for people is valued in both women and men. The good news is, for example, the trend in fathering today, where so many men are beginning to do the work that's stereotypically associated only with mothering, and where we're beginning to talk about a whole different way of looking at the leader, for example, even in the corporation, as the manager no longer being the cop, the controller, the person that you take orders from or else, but as somebody who exercises, again, this power, not power over, but power to elicit from people their highest creativity, their highest potential. What I'm saying is that a lot of the trends in our world today are partnership trends, very strong ones. But also, and I really want to stress this, there is very, very strong dominator resistance. And a lot of course, what happened in the Soviet bloc cannot really be explained in terms of a victory for capitalism. It's a victory for the partnership movement, but it's not a complete victory. There's going to be a lot of dominator regression still before we see the end of this.
That is Rian Eisler. She is the author of a number of books, but probably continues to be best known for her book, The Chalice and the Blade. That was first published in 1987. It is still in print. It's available in 23 foreign editions. She was a guest on our show. Back then we called it Focus 580, and that was in April of 1990. Now, it is true there are some anthropologists who disagree with the picture of prehistoric human society that she presents. They say there simply isn't enough data to support all of her conclusions. But for many people who are interested in gender equality and peacemaking, her ideas have been enormously popular. This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. This year, we are marking 30 years on the air by listening back to some of the oldest shows that we have in our tape archives. These are programs that we first recorded on cassette and have been in storage for a long time. Some of these go back 20 years, and certainly they have not been heard in many years. By the way, you could help us celebrate our 30th anniversary by sharing any comments that you would have about the program, maybe something in general that you'd like to say. You have some thought about some topic, some guest that we had on during the course of the show. You can share your thoughts with us in a couple of ways. You can go to the Focus page on the WILL website. So that's WILL.illinois.edu. And if you look up at the top of the Focus page, there is a place there where you can leave your comments. You can also, if you like, it might be easier, use our email site. So you can write to will-talk, just like it sounds, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. Or if you'd like, you can send a letter, postcard. You can write us using conventional mail. And we are at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana. And the zip is 61801. Well, we are at the midpoint of the program here. We're not taking calls this morning. We're running some archival material. And in the second part of the show, you'll hear a conversation that I had. This one was in 1990 with Gene Owl, the author of the book Clan of the Cave Bear. We'll take a little break. We'll be back. This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. This year, we're marking 30 years on the air by listening back to some of the oldest programs that we have in our tape archives. These are shows that, in most cases, have not been heard since the time that they were first broadcast. So in the second part of the show, we have an interview. This was something from 1991, and it is another conversation with another writer who achieved international fame by writing about the history of early humankind. The guest is Jean Owl. All of this began for her with the publication of her book, Clan of the Cave Bear. That was in 1980. The book tells the story of Ayla. She is a Cro-Magnon girl who's separated from her own people by an earthquake. She is then taken in and raised by a group of Neanderthals and grows to adulthood in early Ice Age Europe. Then the books that followed that, and there are six. The sixth one is just now being published. The books told the story of her search for a mate and then their search for a home. Now, in writing these books, Jean Owl says that she's tried very hard to stick with what science has to tell us about how these people actually lived. Some people, though, have been a little critical of her books, saying that, well, her characters, they're a bit too much like modern people. Her response is, well, that is precisely the point.
Because the whole point that I'm trying to make here is that people who lived in Upper Paleolithic Europe during the Ice Age, the ones that we call Cro-Magnon, were modern people. They had the same kinds of emotional responses, psychological reactions, intelligence range, talents, abilities. What was different is the world that they lived in. So there's no reason that those people would not have at some point in time considered what was their purpose in being there, what was their reason for living. They would not have suffered over loves and hates, dreams, ambitions, hopes, sorrows. That's the whole point. Hmm. I'm trying to show you that these people could have been your college roommate, your neighbor's son, your next-door neighbor, your friend. And the way that I'm doing that, I mean, I'm trying to get beyond the stereotype that these were somehow ugga-mugga savages. Mm. Because even anthropologists will tell you today that the contemporary hunter-gatherer societies that may still be left or that there were until recent times were far more complex, far more modern in their sensibilities than we tend to think.
Well, how do we know that? What are the indications from the, you know, the physical record, the things that we can see and touch, that gives you some insight into what the inner life of these people was like?
Okay, well, first of all, I have to say that we know from looking at their skeletons that they had exactly the same skeletons that we do. Then we have to take a look at their physical culture. You take a look at the art, and you take a look at the artifacts, and you take a look at the many, many things that... And when we're talking about, for example, Eastern Europe, which the mammoth hunters was set, and that's the beginning of the Plains of Passage, that's where they start from. There's interesting kinds of things that you can look at. You can look at the way that they constructed their houses. Okay, now they lived in what was essentially a treeless open plain, grassy plains, right? So you're looking at, and they were huge, what they call megafauna, mammoths and various other animals. And their bones would oftentimes accumulate in places. You know, they would get washed away in the spring floods or whatever. And when they would die natural deaths very often, sometimes they hunted them, but a lot of times the bones would accumulate at certain bends of the river. And the people often built their houses near their lumberyard because they used those bones as the construction materials, as the framing, if you will. But they not only just used them in a haphazard way. Places like Meseritch and Mezin show, for example, the lower mandible, you know, the lower jaw of the mammoth, which is this V-shaped bone. And they were found, you know, with one of them stacked on top of another and showing this sort of what we call a chevron, in other words, you know, a V-shaped thing, and then another one on top of that.
Like sergeant stripes.
Yes. And then they might have one next to it that was stacked in the same way or maybe upside down, so you'd get the zigzag effect, you know. And there was very, very much a design concept. We're talking about the beginnings of architecture here. You take a look at the fact that they had, usually these structures were in a settlement kind of, I mean, these were not totally nomadic people. And you can find artwork, you can find carving, and you can find art that is oftentimes what we would call contemporary modern art. Some of it's very, very representational and very good. Some of the figurines are like, you find figurines of women bird shapes. They look like they're transforming, you know. And you can look at that and say, why would somebody think of that? Well, that's a very modern kind of a concept. But I suppose with all of the things that you can find, and you know that they're human, and you take a look at burials and you can see all kinds of grave goods, one of the things I suppose that I would ask you is, what would make you think that they're not? I mean, what have you learned in your lifetime that would make you think that these were somehow less modern than if they are totally modern in their physical skeleton? Why would you think that they're less? And I think it's because we're still indoctrinated with that 19th century Victorian antiquarian theory that somehow these people were some kind of a missing link, and we can't get beyond that.
I'm interested in this idea that this idea that maybe an important shaping force in advancing humankind is the willingness to do something different,
yes,
to accept change. And we probably all know people who are really good at that, and some people who aren't. Do you think that is, if you were going to make up a list of defining characteristics of modern humankind, would that be an important thing?
That would certainly be, because if you take a look at the differences between modern humans, what you call Homo sapiens sapiens, you know, wise, wise man, right?
Of course, we named ourselves.
Yes, right. As opposed to Homo sapiens neanderthalensis, which is the Neanderthal, which is what my clan is based upon. The differences are really not the ones that we think of. I mean, Neanderthal walked just as upright as we do. They had a cranial capacity that was, on average, larger than ours. They were probably physically stronger by three or four times, at least according to Eric Trinkus and some others who've studied the physical bodies. They had a manual dexterity is at least as good as ours. I mean, the same as ours. There was no question there. The differences that you find are that there was not as much change. You find this very almost resistance to change. And when, you know, if you look at ourselves, if we've been around, okay, since Europe maybe at the earliest about 40,000, now they're beginning to find evidence is perhaps going back as far as 90,000 in Israel. And if Border Cave is effective, then maybe if this very controversial dating of 120,000. But that's, you know, we're really getting controversial. We're saying possibly modern humans have been around, I think the outside they're saying 200,000, moving up out of Africa, maybe. But what we're seeing in the difference is that, number one, for as long as we've been around, at least since Europe, okay, 40,000 years ago, we have effectively changed the face of the earth. We seem to be a people who don't so much adapt to our society and our culture and our world as to make our physical world adapt to us. So we find this tremendous, I mean, what are we, in 40,000 years we have gone from hunting-gathering societies to agriculture, to cities, to technological advances that no one, I mean, we've traveled, we've taken pictures of Saturn, you know. For good or bad, we've changed the face of our earth. That's one of the things. The other thing that's interesting, and right along with that, is there's no evidence of art. Before modern humans, there's no evidence of art. And I find that a fascinating definitive difference. You can find evidence of compassion, and because you can find people like my character of Crab, who's based on a Neanderthal skeleton that was blind in one eye and had an arm amputated. You can find evidence of burial, you know, so they must be thinking, you know, where are we going, where are we coming from, you know, or at least the possibility is there that they were thinking. There is one case that some people have doubted, but I've talked to Ralph Solecki, who actually found the site in Iraq, as a matter of fact, of flowers in a grave. And they did it by pollen analysis, of course. And the flowers have an interesting similarity. The things they have in common is that they tend to be rather showy flowers and that today they have known medicinal values. So, you know, you can draw wonderful speculations from that. But there's no evidence of art. And all of a sudden, there's, I mean, if they did it, they did it on perishable goods. And when we came into the Cro-Magnon or the modern human, suddenly we find evidence of art. And of course, that makes you realize that the same kind of abstracting that you have to do for art is similar to language in its fullest. It's not that they may not have communicated Neanderthals, but if it was in the same way that we do, we don't know.
Do you think if things might have been a little bit different in your life that you would, in fact, have been an anthropologist and chosen the scientific career?
I love science, and I have probably from the very beginning. Of course, I was born in Chicago. I'm actually I was from Illinois in the beginning. Moved to Oregon after I got married, and but basically, I've always had an interest in science. And there was a time when I got married at 18 and graduated from high school, and then had five kids. And then I went back to college. And I was 28 when I started, and I thought I was going to be a physicist. I was taking physics and math. I have math through differential equations and physics and some electronics and so on and so forth. And then I got off into this business thing, and but I've always been interested in science of one form or another. And, yes, I think anthropology and archaeology are fascinating. I'm doing it my way, that's all.
So something else I wanted to ask you, and, you know, I know, again, as we've talked, you have done a lot of research and read very widely to to get the knowledge you have you put in your books. And I'm wondering if you're familiar with the work of Rianne Eisler.
Yes, I have. I've met her a couple of times. She
has been on the program a couple of times by phone. I have not met her personally, but have been interested in talking with
Blade,
her.
Yeah.
Chalice and the Blade.
Well, she's interesting. I have a little trouble with some of her because the area that I am very familiar with is the area that I'm writing about. And, of course, I know the general evolutionary theory because I have to know where my area fits, you know, and what is the scientific feeling about it all. I do find that I have a little trouble with some of her early, when she makes in her book, and I read it, she has a little, she's not exactly entirely accurate with some of all of the facts, but she's gotten it from places. She's done her research, and sometimes all of the sources, especially if they're older sources, are not so accurate. Got to be very careful with copyright dates anymore when you're doing research in this period. I think she's got an interesting theory. It has to do with the fact that that basically it's only been in the last 5,000 years that we became so warlike, and that we can, if we think about it, to come back to a more partnership sort of world. And I like it. I think it sounds good. I can't guarantee that I can't be certain that that's really the way it was. But on the other hand, there's a lot of evidence, I think, to indicate that things were more equally structured in earlier times.
Mm-hmm. That's something that interests me, just to find out how you have thought about that, the whole business of relations between men and women and gender roles, and how you think that these people work those things out.
Well, you know, I came up with a whole set of, I was trying to, in the beginning, trying to come up with a kind of culture that's different from today's. And of course, we have a patriarchal culture, you know. And I started to really just look, and I thought to myself, what if this was, you know, I mean, this time so long ago before people really even fully understood the male role in procreation, you know, what kind of a culture would that evolve? And we have to remember that even the so-called primitive, which I don't even like that word, but the less technologically advanced peoples of today's world have just as long a history as we do. They've gone through as many changes as we have, you know. And we don't know, as the one caller was saying, we were talking about sub-Saharan Africa and some of those ruins that are in that region. I just think that probably things were more equal in earlier days, yes.
Next caller here, line number one. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I have a question that you started talking about just now, some of the differences and similarities with the Neanderthals and the Cro-Magnon.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that fascinated me in the Clan of the Cave Bear was what I assume were speculations, and I'm beginning to see how you've worked into those, on the differences, mental differences between the two groups and the speech versus sign communication.
Mm-hmm,
and what was really interesting was how did you think up the idea of the memories of the
racial memories?
Yes.
Well, actually, what was happening is that I was finding that there were so many similarities, and between ourselves and the Neanderthals, and yet there were differences. You know, if you take a look at that Neanderthal skull. And I've seen one, you know, mm-hmm. compared with, side by side with a skull of a modern human. And it's huge. It's huge. And not only is the cranial capacity larger, but just the sheer thickness of the bone is much thicker. And it was shaped differently. There were less frontal lobes, and there was this tremendous capacity in the rear of the brain. And I was thinking, why? You know, why is it developed that way? And what really started it out was I got, you know, somewhere in the back of my brain, I think I remember. I mean, how many times have you said that or heard somebody say that, you know? And I thought, wait a minute. Wait. And then, of course, there is this wonderful thing that novelists do. It's called What If, you know? And I began to sort of put the pieces together, and it was a long, evolved kind of a thing before I came to it. But every time I would compare it with what we know about the Neanderthal culture, it did not do a great disservice. I mean, it did not. I mean, I expected to get a tremendous amount of flack from the scientific community. And basically, they say, well, it's pretty much off the wall. But most of them will say it does make an interesting story.
Mm-hmm. I have another question about the planning of the series. Did you start out and with sort of a rough outline that book one would do this and book two would do that all up through the...
I thought I was writing a short story, and then it turned into a novel. And I thought it was going to be one big fat novel in six parts. Because once I got into the research and got my whole excitement, my imagination was so fired up. And I almost, you know, I kept thinking, why don't we know this stuff? Why do we have this misimpression? Why do we think that somehow these people were less complex, did not have the same kinds of feelings and emotions? And yes, that was coming through to me in all the scientific material. I mean, it was just standing up and grabbing me. And then I thought, okay, it's because it's not accessible, because the scientific material is fairly dense and fairly dry and turgid, and I thought it needs to be told in a story.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to the subject altogether?
Your guess is as good as mine. I mean it sincerely. Actually, what happened is that it just came. It was one of those ideas that came to me one day, and I had never written. I mean, I'd written poetry. I'd never written fiction. And I was in between jobs. I'd quit my job. I'd just gotten my MBA. I was 40 years old. I was off to do great, wonderful things in business. And I had quit the job, just kind of trying to decide what it is I wanted to do with my life, and got this idea for a story, and that's what headed me off into the research. And basically what happened is I sat down and then wrote what I thought was one novel, that when I went back to look at it, I realized that I didn't have one, I had six. So I do have that first rough draft of the novel is my outline for the whole six-book series.
Let's go on here. Someone on one of our local lines, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Ms. Al, I'd
yes.
just like to say I really enjoy your use of dreams in the books, the way that you use that to give insight and advance the plot and sort of give clues as to what's coming ahead.
Thank you.
That's one of my particular favorite things. I really enjoyed your books a lot. As we sort of pass them around the family, you know.
Oh, good. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, dreams, I think that people, it's an interesting thing. When I write the books, I try to write them from the point of view that anything that's occult, anything that has to do with the spiritualism or the shamanism, is very much understood that this is what those people, the characters in the story, believe. And I oftentimes try to give a hint of why they might take something that we perhaps know differently today, and then they might interpret it in another way. On the other hand, I'm not sure that I have a total handle on that spiritual world, and I think that some of the shamanistic practices may have insights that we don't even know about. So while I have always tried to be very careful to keep the scientific element of it foremost, I'm sure that people who lived in those times certainly did have a spiritual sense, and so that's one of the things that I've tried to do.
Well, it adds so much depth to the story and the characters that you don't often see in books.
Thank you.
And that's really a wonderful thing. We're really glad that you're here.
Hmm. We're at the point here where we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we've used up all of our time. Is it really true, by the way, that as you travel around the country, you meet little girls who are named
yes.
Ayla?
Yes.
There's people actually naming their children
yes,
after your character.
Yes, as a matter of fact, it's wonderful. There was one signing in Santa Clara, California, where it was a two-hour signing, and there were five little girls between the ages of 4 months and 7 years that their parents brought up that were
so
named Ayla.
That says something about the popularity of your...
Well, I hope it's because they feel that the characters of the characteristics and the qualities of the character are something that they feel important.
And that is Jean Owl. She was a guest on our program. Back then, we called it Focus 580 in March of 1991. This series of books that she's written, the Earth's Children series, is one of the most popular book series of all time. It began with The Clan of the Cave Bear. That first book was published in 1980, and it is just now wrapping up with the sixth book, The Land of Painted Caves. It is just out from Crown Publishers. Her books have sold more than 45 million copies worldwide, with almost 22 million copies in the United States alone. This year, we are marking a big anniversary here on this show, 30 years on the air of Focus. We thought one thing that we could do is to bring back some of the oldest shows that we have in our tape archives. But these are programs that are not on the online archives, and these are shows that haven't been heard in a long time. And we'll have some more for you in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, one of the things that we're also trying to do is to collect some comments about the show, to get people to tell us what they think. I expect that there are some people listening who have been listening for a long time, and maybe you have some thought about the show itself or some particular topic or some particular guest that we have had over the last few decades, and we're asking people to share their thoughts with us, and maybe you could take a little time at some point to do that. And again, there are several ways that you can do that. If you go to the WILL main page, that's willill.illinois.edu, and then go to the Focus section and look up at the top. There is a place there that you can share some thoughts, and you can see a few that we've put there on the website. It might be easier, I don't know, and it might be easier for you to write to the email site that we use for the show, and you could do that too. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. Or if you would like to use the more traditional mail, that's fine too. You could drop us a line, write a letter, send a postcard, or whatever you would like to do. And that's WILL Radio, and we are at 300 North Goodwin in Urbana, and the zip is 61801. And particularly, I'd just like you to know what you think about some of these shows that we've been running and about this whole idea of digging back into some of these old programs. So again, if you have the time at some point, you might drop us a line.